if I can help get the word out, if I can help get people interested, if I can help raise money that we need to finish building the sanctuary and the enclosures and bring elephants out of captivity to a wonderful retirement for them, then my work is super fulfilled.
Hello and welcome to Revolutionary Woman. My name is Tess Silverman. Women around the world are constantly creating ways to make a difference in their communities, and today's guest is no exception. Kyla Reynolds-Pan is Head of Development for Pangea Trust, a UK-Portugal-based charity building Europe's largest and most comprehensive elephant sanctuary in the Alentejo region of Portugal. The sanctuary will serve as a compassionate solution for Europe's zoos and circuses seeking a lifelong home for their elephants. Kyla holds a master's in journalism and is the mom of two teenagers. She has more than 20 years of frontline development experience under her belt, including the Smithsonian Institution, Boston University, Harvard Medical School, and Mass Audubon. Hi, Kyla. Welcome to Revolutionary Woman. How are you this afternoon? It's afternoon by you, right?
It is okay. Afternoon by me, Tess. Thanks. It's currently 4:15 p.m.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So you were born in PA, Pennsylvania, and grew up in Connecticut. So what was it like for you growing up in Connecticut?
Well, I was really born and kind of raised for my early life in suburban Philadelphia, but I attended school from the age of 11 until 18 in Connecticut.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Huh. And then you went to college in Tennessee and then grad school in Massachusetts. And then lived in Japan for 3 years. What led you to live in Japan?
In my undergraduate degree was in Japanese studies.
Oh.
So I spent a year in Japan as an exchange student, so my junior year abroad.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And then I went back and worked there for 2 years after I graduated and really came to a crossroads of whether I saw myself settling down and living long term in Japan, or if I didn't, you know, see that as my future. And I really came to the conclusion that Japan lives in my heart and lives in my family's heart. I mean, I make a fair amount of Japanese food and things still. So my son loves Japan, even though he has visited, but he hasn't spent much time there. But but it's one of those countries where, as a blonde American, I would never really fully fit in. And I didn't like that feeling.
Oh, okay. Was it a good experience on the whole, or was it hard to fit in? Was it hard to, like, you know, since you lived there for a few years?
I always recount my experience in Japan as living like an honorary male.
Really?
Because as a, I think, you know, Americans are, until recently, Americans have been very, very lucky that in many countries we're, you know, very positively viewed and well treated as a result of World War II and a very positive initial role in, you know, in the world on the global spectrum. Mm-hmm. But so as an American woman, I was treated in a much higher regard than most of my Japanese colleagues, female colleagues.
Wow.
And when I lived in more urban Japan, which was Kyoto and Osaka as a junior in college, I didn't notice it as much. But when I went back to work there after graduation, I really lived in rural Japan down in Kumamoto Prefecture. In a smaller, much smaller village. And I really noticed that. And I definitely felt not animosity, but some, you know, frustration from my female Japanese counterparts, because I was invited to things that they didn't have privilege to or wouldn't be invited to, like some, you know, after they do a lot of after work drinking parties called enkais and things like that. And, And I often was included because I was more of a, you know, an anomaly or a novelty. And you know, I think it was really that experience that led me to say, you know, I really, really have loved my journey with Japan, but I don't see this as my future.
Okay. Wow. I mean, that sounds really interesting and also must have been frustrating because you saw yourself as, you know, like you said, being included while your other, your friends who were Japanese were not. And it's like, it's got to be like bizarre in a way. But yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. Okay, so your profession was in the nonprofit sector, fundraising for U.S. academic and cultural institutions. What drew you to fundraising?
So after I moved back from Japan in 1997, mm-hmm. It was after the tiger economies had sort of collapsed, and you may remember in 95, there was this peak of like Japan, you know, purchased Rockefeller Center and had some really big, you know, they just seemed like, wow, that was the way of the future. If you wanted to, you know, get a successful job, you should maybe learn some Japanese. Uh-huh. And then of course the tiger economies kind of collapsed in 97. Mm. And that's when I came back to the US and I thought, well, maybe I won't use all of my Japanese language and cultural knowledge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a young 20 something, I really was trying to figure out what will I do? What's my next career move? Mm-hmm. And I really, by kind of just circumstance, I was living in Boston, and by circumstance, I fell into filling a temporary role at Harvard Medical School.
Oh, wow.
In their development office. Uh-huh. And my career just sort of took off from there. I really got to know the field. I had a really great mentor there. Mm-hmm. I was there for just under a year. And then through my mentor there was connected with a position at Boston University. And then everything kind of grew from that point forward.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So you currently live in Portugal and mm-hmm. you are the head of development for Pangea. But first of all, what led you to Portugal?
After working in the nonprofit sector and in fundraising for large institutions for a long time, and my last position was at the Smithsonian Institution, I really, when we started a family, when my second child was born, I really decided that, and had the real, I recognize it, a very deep privilege of being able to opt out of the workforce for a while. Mm-hmm. So I did, to focus on raising a family and supporting a husband who traveled a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was my husband's job that he was hired by a Portuguese tech company, really to kind of work in their Boston office, but a variety of factors led us to being placed in Portugal to work with a team here for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And that was just before COVID. Our kids were 10 and 13 at that time.
Uh-huh.
And then when COVID hit, I think everybody really reassessed their lives and where they were and where what brought them true, you know, value and contentment. And for us, Portugal has been all of that.
That's amazing. Okay, so what is Pangea about and what does your role entail?
Okay, so Pangea or Pangea Trust, either one, is Europe's first large-scale elephant sanctuary.
Hmm.
And what an elephant sanctuary is, for any of your listeners who may not know, it is really like any kind of wildlife sanctuary where rather than, you know, a safari park or something, or something even like a national park like mm-hmm. Yellowstone, mm-hmm. where people can go and see wildlife in its natural habitat, a mm-hmm. sanctuary is really meant to be exactly as the word defines, a sanctuary for rescued or rehabilitated sometimes wildlife. And in this case, it is a closed to the public, except on very, you know, rare occasions per year, and really meant to rehabilitate formerly captive elephants from Europe's circuses, zoos, and safari parks, because it was, you know, there has been so many studies about what major keystone species like elephants require, and they're a huge, long wandering, you know, they walk tens of kilometers or miles a day. Mm-hmm. They are big wanderers, and they are very social, and they are very intelligent, and really require a lot that being in captivity cannot mm-hmm. provide for them, even in some of the best circumstances. And the first elephant sanctuary that opened of this caliber was in the United States in 1995, and it's called the Elephant Sanctuary. Huh. And it has really taken Europe this many years to finally be able to collectively launch an elephant sanctuary here. And the irony is that the most elephants in captivity in the world, outside of their native regions and outside of their where they're indigenous to, is mm-hmm. Europe.
Really? Huh, that is interesting. Wow. I mean, why is that?
Back in the 1980s, there really was an uptick in the elephant in the ivory trade.
Oh.
For many reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's not one that I'm, you know, an authority enough to talk at length. Why was there such a big surge in the ivory trade then? But poaching really increased in Africa. You know, they were, of course, going for tuskers and tusked animals and anything that, you know, had ivory. And a lot of adult elephants were killed and poached, leaving orphaned baby elephants behind. And, you know, baby elephants are pretty small and pretty trainable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very, very sad if you look into the history of this and any kind of documentaries about this, but they were a secondary trade or a secondary profit from this ivory trade was selling baby elephants their closest neighbor, which was the continent of Europe. So there are more than 600 elephants in captivity. They are not all African elephants, but I believe that the statistics are about 60% of them are.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's just crazy. Holy cow.
It's really sad too. I mean, in the past year working with Pangea, I have definitely had some very eye-opening exposure to, you know, things that I think a lot of us grew up with feeling that it was very innocuous or even a positive experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Taking our kids to a really lovely zoo or, mm-hmm. you know, being around animals. And, you know, it's sobering when you learn, kind of learn the other side of the coin.
Wow. So what was your aha moment when you thought you wanted to be a part of Pangea?
Right before we moved to Portugal, mm-hmm. 2019, I definitely was at a stage of wanting to get back into the work world. My kids were getting older. I realized I still had a lot of, you know, a lot of career potential and had, you know, certainly had worked hard academically to mm-hmm. get a master's in journalism and speak Japanese and things like that. And I thought, okay, well, I'm ready to get back into the work world. Mm-hmm. And then we moved here and a couple of years went by. And as we settled in, I thought, wow, I really want to give back to Portugal. I really want to you know, figure out how I can work here. I wonder if there's anything that would, you know, benefit from my skill set. Mm-hmm. And really, Portugal in particular and many European countries are either nascent or almost non-existent in the philanthropic world. It's just not something that is nothing like in the United States, which is the world's most philanthropic country, mostly because they're taxed so high that they already feel they've contributed to the greater good in mm-hmm. their country through, you know, being taxed sometimes almost at 40, 40% of their income a year. So it has been very, when this opportunity arose and it was philanthropy, nonprofit, fundraising based in Portugal, but really from a UK founded organization. And so if US is the top philanthropic country, the second is the UK. So it has been a really eye-opening journey to learn about how Europeans view philanthropy, how they engage with philanthropy, how they, the perception they have of Pangea. I've had a lot of different, you know, feedback from native Portuguese where they think, you know, in some cases that it feels frivolous that we're doing something for animals when there are also, you know, lots of other areas that we could be putting this kind of money towards. But I think when you really, you know, the animal welfare world is broad and vast. And I think on the whole, I mean, who doesn't love elephants?
Yeah. So Kyla, have you always been an advocate of wildlife conservation? Was this something that you had thought about before you even got into Pangea?
I've always loved nature, and I've always been a big, you know, animal lover. I did not have any exposure aside from, you know, my travels in Asia and certainly in Thailand and India. I didn't have exposure to elephants really in the wild, and I've never been on safari. So my knowledge of elephants has really been exponential in the past 12 months working with Pangea. But I have, you know, my former work was mostly in academia and museums. So really this has been a huge learning curve to, you know, learn about wildlife conservation, animal welfare, elephants in particular, the entire, you know, the whole world behind zoos and circuses. It's really, really interesting and eye-opening.
I love that. On your site, it says Pangea is dedicated to providing a lifelong home for Europe's elephants in need. And I also read on the site that a female African elephant named Kariba will be the first elephant to call Pangea her home. That is so cool. So how did that come about?
So we are really excited about this. In fact, we've really, you know, since Pangea was first founded, which was in 2017, and yet we're still very much in the startup mode because, you know, funding was kind of decided in 2017 and the concept was evolved. And then there was some backing, large foundations that backed this whole movement towards Pangea. But really, it wasn't until 2023 that we were able to purchase the land. I mean, they looked, you know, in multiple places around Europe, and then they kind of narrowed down the Iberian Peninsula because the climate is very friendly, elephant friendly, and the landscape is. Really, it was our director, Kate Moore, who is an absolute champion and an absolute superwoman. She was really manning the whole thing. With, you know, the board of trustees and she at the helm. And then I was brought on board a year ago with, simultaneously too, so that I'm head of development. And then they also brought on the head of communications. And we were both brought on in November of 2024. And our hope was that the first elephant we would be bringing to Pangea. And at that point, we hadn't even, you know, we had the land, we own the land, we have 1,000 acres in the Alentejo, but we hadn't put up any elephant fencing, we hadn't converted barns, we hadn't, you know, there was a lot of infrastructure we needed to focus on, which we've done in this past year. And we really thought that our first elephant might be the last circus, Portuguese circus elephant, surviving Portuguese circus elephant. We still very much hope that we will get that beautiful elephant, but it is still in negotiation. So our first elephant is this one that you saw on our site, Kariba, which is an African female, and she's coming from a safari park in Belgium. And the owner of that safari park really recognized that she had a companion who died in 2022. Oh. And I mean, two elephants is already a lonely situation. Mm. One elephant is just a heartbreakingly sad situation because they are very social. And so he has been looking for an alternative for her. And when he learned about Pangea, this was just such a great opportunity for Kariba and for them to get out of the elephant, you know, captivity business. That, you know, this has really just come about in the last few months. Really, my colleague who works on partnership leads, who is Dutch, knew someone involved in a large animal welfare organization that she was working with, and they knew about this elephant and this situation, and all these little pieces came together, and hopefully in January or February 2026 we will finally be able to give Kariba a beautiful, huge roaming area where she can forage and behave like her wild counterparts, and hopefully very soon thereafter we will be able to bring the African female last Portuguese circus elephant to be a companion for her. And then, you know, I hope that we will focus for a little while on African females so we can expand that herd and see where things go from there.
Oh, Kyla, that is really cool. I mean,
yeah, it's really,
you know,
I
that
get
is
really
excited
cool. for them.
Yeah. So how long, I mean, you mentioned like a few months, but how long does the process take from when you get notified that an elephant needs to be rehomed to actually being transported to Pangea?
That's a really great question. So we're really lucky that, I mean, I can't even imagine in 1995 when the original people that were putting together the Elephant Sanctuary, Tennessee, which is, you know, we know as fondly as Tess, the Elephant Sanctuary, when they were building it, and this was such a novel concept to create this sort of, you know, elephant sanctuary and take elephants out of captivity. They had no one else to really look towards for any, you know, there were, they were creating the mold. And, you know, now we're really lucky because we have Tess as one of our, you know, sister sanctuaries that we look towards for advice. And one that we work the most closely with is Global Sanctuaries for Elephants. And they have a sanctuary. The co-founder actually of Tess moved down in 2015 to Brazil to open a sanctuary in South America called Elephant Sanctuary Brazil. And that gentleman, Scott Blaze, and his wife, Kat, have been unbelievably phenomenal advisors to us. And we have watched, you know, so many of their elephant rescues. I think they're up to 7 or 8 elephants now.
Oh, wow.
And so the answer to your question is it can take anywhere, you know, it can be a quick process. I actually think Kariba has been a pretty quick process that we've, you know, identified this elephant looking to be rehomed just a couple of months ago. And now we will need to crate train her so that she feels comfortable getting into a transport crate. And that will take, you know, anywhere from 1 to 2 months for that process, sometimes longer, depending on the each elephant is different. And then we really hope that, you know, that she will be with us by February.
Wow.
But again, you know, then there are other elephants, like circus elephants, who are really used to being transported. And so the training of getting them to be comfortable in a crate is much faster. And that could be a much faster process. But each one is really like, and the other complication that we're dealing with, and I guess also our sister sanctuary, the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil, is that each elephant or all these different elephants that we're dealing with are, you know, in some cases coming from different countries, and each country has different policies. And we have to, you know, deal with different legislature and transport issues and things like that. So it is a very, very multi-layered process.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I just wondered about that because, you know, from start to finish, I would think it would take a few months. But like you said, it depends on the elephant and as well as the different countries. So, well, okay. So thank you for that. Who would you credit for where you are now?
I have had a number of really inspirational women that I've looked up to in my career that have really, fundraising, I don't think is typically one of those careers that people get a degree in or think that they're going to, end up in while they're in college or coming out of college. It mm-hmm. often is one of those things that, one thing leads to another and planets align and you end up getting involved with, fundraising or the development world or the alumni world or, sort of all these intertwining departments. And for me, I think, I really grew up with parents who were very philanthropic and very giving. And my mom is really a huge nature lover. And, we bred dogs when we were little and we were always supporting different sort of animal shelters and things like that. Mm-hmm. And when I ended up in the nonprofit world, I really think that the women I worked under were really inspiring to me because they were extremely, nobody in the nonprofit mm-hmm. is making enough money to retire early or, nobody's working in the nonprofit to come out ahead. They're, mm-hmm. most people in the nonprofit sector are doing it because there's a deep sense of altruism and, mm-hmm. Love for a passion for what you do. And it's a really amazing sector to work in because I think it's a very fulfilling, meaningful work for most people. Mm-hmm. And so, putting in the hours and not necessarily, seeing that reflected in a paycheck is just what you sign up for when you get into the nonprofit world. So I guess I don't know that there's one person that I would credit for where I am now. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of parts of people like my mentor at the Smithsonian when I was worked in a high dollar membership there, Laura Brouse Long. She was probably one of the most influential people for me because she was incredibly encouraging, really helped me develop my career, really gave me great exposure. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of women and men, but a lot of women for sure. It is a very heavily female oriented profession for some reason, but there mm-hmm. were a lot that really inspired me and made me want to, grow and do better.
What's next for you and Pangea?
So Giving Tuesday happens on December 2nd. Mm-hmm. It is right now, it is November 19th while we're recording this. Giving Tuesday is huge in the US. Giving Tuesday has become sort of a global big thing. It's not as big over in Europe or over in this part of Europe, at least, because mm-hmm. again, as I was saying, it's not, they don't have as much of a culture of philanthropy yet. Mm-hmm. So that said, Giving Tuesday is not like my, break all moment, but really end of year giving. And we just went public with up until November 7th. If people knew about Pangea, it's because they came upon our website by, pure chance, or they saw something on social media. But we were in a very quiet phase while we were completing construction and getting things lined up and getting things ready mm-hmm. Of this campaign. And now on November 7th, we had a really successful local press release that we were expecting 45 journalists, mostly from around Portugal, just to get the word out and go public. And mm-hmm. We had, some BBC reporters and we've had reporters from Switzerland and from Germany that have been reaching out. And we ended up with 90 people at the initial press conference. And wow. I would say since November 7th, we have been delightfully, flooded with, inquiries and emails and small donations. And now we've put public that our first elephant is Kariba. So we announced that the day after that press release. Mm-hmm. And it really feels like, if in the past 11 months, it was really hard to go out and tell people, try to fundraise for something that nobody knew existed and hadn't heard of.
Right.
Now it feels really uplifting and exciting because at least locally, most Portuguese, friends and neighbors that I have that knew I was connected with Pangea. The moment we went public, that I got all these messages. Oh, I saw Pangea in the news. I saw Pangea. I just saw it on TV. And, you know, it's really an exciting time. And so if Giving Tuesday is sort of this 3% return rate, end of year giving is a 12% return rate, where a lot of charities kind of make up 12% of what they make in the whole year in the last 3 days of a calendar year. So really, this is what I'm kind of now with people, you know, I'm responding to emails and to donor inquiries and to people that, you know, can I sponsor an elephant? How can we visit the sanctuary?
Oh, that's so cool.
You know, it's really cool. And it's really wonderful to, you know, share this information with you, Tess, and with your listeners, and with people that are now really excited about this project, and people that have been moved to tears about, you know, learning that this is happening. I think the Portuguese are really proud that this is in their backyard and it benefits all captive elephants in Europe. I mean, that's just who the Portuguese are. They're an incredibly warm and welcoming country and people. And I think I'm really, really happy to be giving back and involved in this way here in Portugal.
That's awesome. So if anyone wanted to know more about you and Pangea, how would they go about it?
Well, I'm definitely not by any means the star of Pangea. The star of Pangea is definitely Kate Moore, our director. They can, you know, find out a lot more about Pangea, what we're doing, the elephants, as we, you know, as we rescue elephants and as elephants are, you know, turned over to our care. We'll start to have all of that up on our website, which is www.pangeatrust.org. I mean, I think it's a really pretty landing page for anybody that wants to know more information about Pangea. We have a great FAQ, frequently asked questions page, that gives some good information. We have a lot of information about Kariba, what we know about her. We'll certainly put details of her movements and rehoming at Pangea as we move between now and February, when we hope to have her at the sanctuary. But really, I am just a humble servant of this project. And I'm basically, I always say fundraising is kind of the sales department of the nonprofit world. So if I can help get the word out, if I can help get people interested, if I can help raise money that we, you know, need to finish building the sanctuary and the enclosures and bring elephants out of captivity to a wonderful retirement for them, then my work is, you know, super fulfilled.
Okay, so if you had one thing to change that you wish you had done years ago, would there be one?
I mean, life is a choose your own adventure, right? And you never know what would happen if you turn to a different page instead. I can't imagine. I mean, I don't use Japanese at all and I haven't used it in the past, you know, 20 years, but I wouldn't change, you know, my experience of having an opportunity to live in a foreign and an Asian culture and the exposure that I've had. And, you know, I'm married to an Asian American and our kids, you know, very much straddle, you know, they're kind of that third culture kid, because they're, you know, biracial, but then at, you know, kind of formative years moved to a third country or a second country, but a third culture. And, you know, and I don't think I would change anything, because then I wouldn't be who I am today. And maybe I wouldn't be working for Pangea and I wouldn't be on this path. And I'm really, really happy and really, really content to be doing what I'm doing where I am.
Wonderful. And my last question is, if you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
I would give advice to figure out ways that you can really chart a path, chart a course, you know, to be open to opportunities, to figure out what it is. You know, don't necessarily feel like you need to do something because it's going to yield the biggest paycheck. Sometimes the biggest paycheck is how rewarding your work is. And sometimes we don't end up using what we thought we were going to focus on for our careers and majored in college or grad school, but it does play a part of who we become professionally and what we can give back you know, on a humanitarian level. And I'm really, I think I would just say, you know, be open, be compassionate, be kind, and try to really learn from people who, you know, look up to the people that you admire. Shadow them, you know, ask questions and find out how they do what they're doing or how they got good at what they're doing. I don't think I, you know, did that early enough. I sort of let other people dictate which path and career I was going into until this one sort of landed in my lap. And then I, you know, evolved. And I think, you know, I think listen to what you're good at and be authentic.
I love that. Thank you for that. Because, you know, I, as you're saying that, I'm like, yep, I remember, because I was pushed as well into something that would I could make a living at, you know, and for years, I really did not like where I was until I was, it was suggested that maybe that wasn't for me and I needed to get out if I was unhappy. And I'm glad I listened because, you know, like you said, whatever you learned over the years, you can pick parts of it that you can use, you know, in your later years. And I definitely have seen that for me. So thank you for that. I love that. Oh my gosh.
You're welcome, Tess. And I think what's really special, and you can feel free to cut this out or keep it in, but, you know, you and I have walked a really neat journey together. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember how long. I mean, I was involved with World Moms Blog, then World Moms Network,
right,
from 2009 on. And you joined us in,
I think, 2012, 13, something like that.
And, you know, that was such, I mean, okay, there's somebody who really has inspired me, maybe not in the fundraising world, but as a human, Jennifer Burden. I mean, what an amazing individual. And all the women that she's connected and brought together, and the ways that, you know, we've gone out into the world and, you know, just the things we've shared and the ways we've discovered who we are and what we can contribute beyond, you know, beyond mom blogging and beyond that network, social good and all of that.
I definitely second that. I love Jen, and she definitely has given to open up opportunities for women like us, you know, and so many amazing women that I call my friends, you know, and it's lovely. And it's just so empowering to know that that she was able to provide that opportunity for us, you know, and to be able to create our own paths afterwards, you know. So that's really, I love that. And I love her.
But she's an amazing person.
Yeah, she really is. Oh my gosh. Yeah, shout out to Jen. But thank you for coming on my show and for sharing your life and your work with me. And your work now with Pangea is so exciting, and I can't wait to, like, find out more of when Kariba comes and, you know, like, more elephants who are going to be happy in this new environment that they so deserve. So,
Tess, it's been such a pleasure to reconnect with you in this manner and to be on your show. And you're right. I mean, talking about the work that we do and how we got here, it is, like, I totally feel motivated. Like, when we hang up, even though it's 5 o'clock here, I'm, you know, definitely there. The thing about the nonprofit world is there's always more to do.
Oh yeah. I'm sure.
But I'm really, you know, I feel buoyed up talking to you, and it's been really, thank you for having me on your show. And I really love, I really love this time together.
Yeah, same here. And I look forward to hearing more about Pangea and Kariba and all the other elephants that are going to be calling Pangea their home. So I look forward to that. So please keep me posted. And with that, have a great day, and I will speak with you soon. Take it easy.
Okay.
Bye. That's our show for today. I've posted more information about Kyla Reynolds Pan on RevWoman.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in every other Thursday for another episode of Revolutionary Woman. You can listen to Revolutionary Woman on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcast. Just a little note, I've launched a Patreon account to support the show. All proceeds will go to producing and editing the episodes to give my poor husband a break from being my personal IT and production department. He wrote this. The address is patreon.com/revwoman.